Good morning. You're listening to KTNA 88.9 FM Talkeetna. I'm Philip Manning. Today on Susitna Valley Voice, my guests are John Leonard, South District Ranger for Denali National Park, and Roger Robinson, Mountaineering Ranger for Denali National Park. Climbing season is almost upon us, and we're going to be discussing all things Denali for the next hour. If you want to take part in our conversation, you can call us at 733-1200 or send an email to dj@ktna.org. You can also send us a message via Facebook, and I'll be checking that as the hour goes on. So, good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Morning.
So, thanks for joining us. Like I said, we're just getting into climbing season. We were talking a little bit before we came on air that the early preparations for base camp are starting to happen. What's the timeline looking like for opening base camp up there this year?
You know, we'll have our folks up there. The first patrol goes in just the first part of May, first couple days of May. And like you said, as we speak, loads are flying up towards the mountain and trying to get everything established.
Okay. So I'd like to start, you know, everybody is obviously aware of the mountain around here and the impact that it has on the town in a number of ways. But I think that there's at least... For my part, I can say that until fairly recently, I didn't know just a ton about what actually goes on up there, and there's still obviously a lot that I have left to learn, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you guys in here today, is to kind of discuss what goes into climbing Denali. And Roger, we can start with you. So, in terms of, you know, how long does it usually take these groups of climbers or single climbers to get up and down Denali?
Well, in our statistics, the average time period is 16 or 17 days. We recommend 3 weeks for the West Buttress, which is the easiest way up the mountain. Or I would say it is the easiest way, but nothing's easy on Denali. But you know, we have people that'll climb it in 10 days, but we recommend taking the 3 weeks time to do it, and that gives good acclimatization and the waiting for the weather. I think optimal, if you had perfect weather every day, it'd be about 14 days round trip.
Okay. And so when it comes to preparing for a climb on Denali, obviously it's over 20,000 feet tall, so you do have to acclimate to the elevation, less oxygen, as well as the physical exertion. What sort of physical training and what sort of physical shape does someone have to be in order to make that climb?
Well, you have to be in pretty good shape. It's you're moving with all your stuff. Most people will take off from base camp with well over 100 pounds, maybe 150 pounds, depending on how much stuff they can't get rid of at the start. But... you know, and you're carrying a good-sized pack and pulling a good-sized sled and going uphill with it. So it's pretty arduous. And, you know, so that weight alone makes it pretty tough. And then you're starting out at 7,000 feet. Most people are acclimatized to pretty much sea level in the world. So they're huffing and puffing the first day out, second day out. They're working hard from get-go. And that's why taking your time and going up. But, you know, once you get up to 14,000, like that's the height of Mount Rainier, the real climb begins at that point. So, you know, that's where, you know, it seems like, oh gosh, we got this high. And for a lot of people, that's pretty neat. But you know, the real things occur, the toughness, the difficulties, the real weather situations are up high. Yeah.
Okay. And so with that, you know, one of the things, too, that I learned in my former life working at the airport across the way here is that as far as total distance traveled, these climbers aren't just climbing the mountain one time. You get a lot of gear shuttling and things like that as part of the acclimatization in most cases. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah. You know, the... using the sleds allows you to move along pretty quickly for the first week or so. And but once you move above 11,000, people start making the double carry and pretty much double carry the rest of the way. So you are, you know, going up and down 11 to 14, 14 to say up on the ridge at 16, then finally move to 17, back down possibly to, if the things aren't good, then maybe move back up again to for the summit day and the summit up and back. But like when we first did our trip, it was before the invention of sleds, and it seems like a long time ago now, but we did a different route, but it ended up, we were out over a month, and we started off with 3 80-pound loads out of base camp. And of course, 3 loads means 3 carries, and you're moving very slow. But
so when you say a carry, that's a trip back and forth?
That's a trip back and forth, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's that is a lot of back and forth on a very big mountain. So, you know, speaking of gear, well, actually, I guess first, when was the first time you went up the mountain?
My first trip was 1975.
Okay.
And, yeah.
And John, have you done Denali?
Yeah, my first trip was in 1994.
Okay. So, I mean, in 20 years even, there was probably some big advances in gear. And then 20 years from, John, your first trip to now, what would you guys say has been the biggest innovation as far as climbing gear? John, we'll start with you.
Geez, the quality of gear has advanced so far. You know, to think that Roger was back here climbing before we were using sleds, that takes us back quite a way. Roger says, well, it seems like a while. I'm like, no, actually it was quite a while. But the quality of gear really that keeps you warm and how light stuff has become has really changed even in the short period of time that I've been climbing here.
Roger?
You know, I think part of it is a knowledge about what's changed is knowledge about safe ways to climb. I mean, when we started, nobody knew anything about cerebral edema. That wasn't even a word used. And that took another 10 years before that became part of the lingo. And that's where you develop altitude problems related to brain swelling.
Okay.
And, it can come on quite rapidly. And back then, pulmonary edema was known, but the only thing we knew how to treat it was with injections of Lasix, and totally the wrong way to treat it. And we just didn't really have a good handle on any altitude-related things other than to go down and pray that someone wouldn't die on your trip.
Wow. And so obviously that's changed a lot.
Yeah.
A pretty significant change here in recent years is the amount of people that are coming with the use of a guide. And last year was the first year on Denali where the climbers coming with some of our concessionaires surpassed those of the non or independent climbers that we call them are doing. So people are seeking more help to come up the mountain, which I think in a lot of ways is a very good thing.
Okay. And so you have a number of concessionaires. And so how does that, as while we're on that subject, how does that work as far as how many climbers are each of those groups allowed to bring? Is it the same for each one or does it vary?
It's the same for each one. And a lot of the rules that we have in place go back quite a long time. And Roger can speak better to their origins, but the kind of ratios or limits we have in place right now for commercial groups, our concessionaires, is that they can start 18 clients every 14 days.
Okay. And so part of that, too, is what people may not realize is that if you're going to climb the mountain, you need a permit from the Park Service in order to climb the mountain. And there's a 60-day waiting period on that.
There is, and it's tiered a little bit based on experience, whether or not you've been here in the past. But Roger again can help with the history on this. But my recollection is this: the 60-day rule goes back to a number of incidents, but the one that sticks out in my mind was, I believe, two German climbers or Austrian climbers, Roger, that were over in Alaska on a vacation, and kind of on a whim, they decided to go climb Denali, and it was a man and his girlfriend that they came over not prepared, came up and climbed Denali, and I believe both died of exposure somewhere up above Denali Pass.
Yeah, and they just sat down. Coming down, they altitude got to them, and they just sat down and died right on the trail.
Wow.
And I remember when I first came here, and when the ranger station was over by the airport there in the what's now the chocolate shop, but the building's obviously moved, that most people probably in town know. But climbers would come in with interest about Denali, and Roger or the other rangers would open up this book and say, well, can we interest you in Mount Brooks maybe, or something that's a little smaller until you get more prepared to come up and climb.
And, you know, one of the other things that I know a lot of the services do around here, too, is they'll actually take folks who are less experienced in the Alaska range and take them up to a lower part of the range for like 10 or 12 days and get them trained up as well out there. So while we're on the subject of mountain safety, specifically with Denali, you know, I did a few stories last year about how last year was really a pretty good year for safety on Denali. We had no climbing accidents that resulted in death, relatively few with serious injuries. And, you know, in a lot of cases, you kind of expect someone at some point, unfortunately, to have a pretty bad incident up there. And obviously, right now in the news, people have heard about what happened on Everest with the ice fall avalanche situation that happened out there. At least 13 of the Sherpas died in that. So when we talk about Denali, what's the biggest danger as far as hazards go to a climber on Denali, Roger?
Well, you know, just statistically, it would be altitude related. Mm. You know, people climbing too fast or not familiar with how their body adapts. So we see, you know, that kind of causes other problems that occur. But altitude is the big one, and then frostbite is our second big one. And we, you know, depending on how cold it is during the season, how much wind we get up high, we see a lot of frostbite earlier than later. But sometimes it's quite a few, almost one person, every other group will get it at the start of the season, which is, we have people that are lining up for this next week. So our season's going. Yeah.
And I guess we talked about when the season starts, but we haven't really gone into when the official, unofficial season kind of ends on Denali. What in the summertime, what time frame are we looking at for people being up there?
You know, there's about a 45-day period that's optimum, and it's really kind of from early May to actually mid-May to end of June is a pretty good time period to be on the mountain, at least up high. It's just so cold earlier, and then we start getting the more precip in July. Mm. Our driest months are April, May, and June, and by the end of June we start seeing longer storms, as we all know, and then of course by August it's we're inundated with rain here. Well, it's snowing up there, and some big avalanches are probably taking place.
Okay.
My earlier years, we had some of our biggest scares in late July and August with avalanches. But, you know, and in recent years, the season's gotten shorter just because the runway at the Kahiltna Southeast Fork has gotten pretty rough and even opened up with a lot of crevasses.
Okay.
Never saw that in the past. We could run year-round up there. Until like the last 10 years, it was never, crevasses weren't really an issue. And now the severe melting we're getting, and we're seeing the season shut down by around the 4th of July often.
Wow.
Where it ran all the way through to as long as you wanted to climb.
Okay. So base camp there, like you said, is on the southeast fork of the Kahiltna Glacier, which is on the western side.
It's just, if you're looking from Talkeetna, it is directly over Mount Hunter, on the opposite side of Mount Hunter.
Okay.
So you really can't see it, but it is, if you use the highest point of Mount Hunter, then it's directly on the opposite side of it.
Okay, as far as orientation.
Looking at it, yeah.
I gotcha. And so, you know, that becomes, over the course of the summer, one of the busier airports in Alaska, up there on the Kahiltna Glacier. And so when you talk about crevasses, you know, I did an interview with Willie Pretty last week, talking about some of the hazards up there too, and that was one of the things he mentioned as well, was crevasses and the dangers involved there. You also talked a little bit about the weather. Can you tell me what sort of extremes? What are some of the extremes that climbers can encounter even in the nicer months of the year while they're up there?
Well, you know, it tends to all be related to weather systems that come through. There's a new book coming out, and it's all based around the Wilcox Party, which had a big tragedy, the worst one on Denali's history, back in the late 60s. But there were winds there in excess of 200 miles an hour, and that's been quoted by quite a few meteorologists. But so that the winds can get that strong, and that was in July, not in the middle of winter. Mm. If the weather system comes in out of the northwest, which is not very common, you can get those kind of upper winds, I say. But and we get a big system in from the south. You know, we'll see winds hitting probably 100 miles an hour, and that's probably each season we'll get one or two like that that can really knock down walls that people built around their tents, keep everybody pretty much camp bound for a few days.
Okay. And then, you know, I mentioned that last year was a pretty good year as far as numbers of rescues that had to be done goes. Year before, I had definitely had a lot more, and of course, did have some deaths. What is kind of the process when the Park Service and when somebody is in distress up there, serious distress, and needs a rescue off of the mountain? John, can you tell me kind of how does that process get started and how does it work?
Well, search and rescue in national parks is actually a discretionary function, and in any of the rescues that we partake in, the first place that we start at is rescuer safety, and when I think of different people's emergencies, it reminds me of Daryl Miller's license plate that he has. And Daryl was a longtime ranger here in District Ranger. And Daryl's license plate says, "Your emergency is not my emergency." So we respond to other people's emergencies, but they're not our emergencies. And before we take anything on, we have to be pretty systematic in how we respond. To ensure that we're not putting park staff at risk and creating a bigger problem than what already exists. And typically we have 20-ish rescues a year, Roger, somewhere along there. You mentioned, last year was just a great year. It was, though we had one death, it was of natural causes, and that could have happened here on the streets of Talkeetna just as easy as it happened on the mountain. Hopefully we'll have another really good year this year and people will stay safe. That's really what we hope, is that our educational efforts that we do on the front end of people coming here can have them better prepared, so when they're in places where they're making decisions, things don't start to snowball on them. And when we see really bad things happen, a lot of times it's this culmination of a lot of prior decisions that were just a little bit off. You know, there's days that sometimes when you're in mountains, just bad things happen and you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that can be said for any place that you're at in the world, whether it's, you know, on a city street corner or up in the mountains. But, you know, our hope is that we can get people coming here as prepared as they are, so when they are faced with difficult decisions, that they're hopefully making the right ones.
Okay. And so, part of that, you were talking about education and for the climbers as they come up here. My understanding is that everybody kind of has to go through a briefing at the ranger station, or at least a lot of the folks have to go through a briefing before they actually get on their plane and go up to base camp. What does that entail, Roger? Is that's kind of your area, I think?
Well, I've been doing those for a long time, but you know, it's really good for our staff to visit with each of these groups as they come through, and we literally book some time with them. It's like coming to a doctor's office, and you go in, though we're a lot slower than a doctor as far as examination goes. But it's really good to get a handle on who these people are and what they kind of know. And we have a little PowerPoint we give to them, And from answers they give us, we can field, you know, good questions and answers. You know, it is in some ways our last effort of really communicating with these folks before they take off. And sometimes, you know, we'll pick up on some things and they may learn a little bit before they go. But it's more than just that briefing, because we have a great online site with lots and lots of information on safe ways to climb. And then there's a lot of guidebooks out today that didn't used to exist on safe ways to get up the mountain. So you add all those up, and then people generally talk to others that have climbed here. So they're not coming as ignorant as they once did. And so it all adds up to being fairly educated on what they're getting into from what I've seen from say 30 or 40 years ago.
Okay. You're listening to Susitna Valley Voice with guests Roger Robinson and John Leonard of the National Park Service for Denali National Park. If you want to join in on our conversation, you can call 733-1200 or send an email to dj@ktna.org. I'll be firing up the KTNA Facebook page here momentarily. So if you want to join in the conversation that way, you can get in touch with us there. I guess kind of a related question to the briefings and the trainings and climber awareness, what sort of discretionary power is there on the part of the park? If somebody walks in, they've applied for their permit 60 days out, they come into your briefing, and it's clear that they don't know what they're doing. Can that be, what options exist for you guys at that point?
You know, really, as long as a climber or wannabe climber fills out the paperwork right and meets the requirements on time, we are not able to judge them based on what we believe their experience is or lack thereof experience. Which, you know, puts us in some tough spots at different times when you can see the train coming and there's no way to stop it. We really try to impress upon people the seriousness of the endeavor they're about to undertake. And Roger actually has a real knack for delivering that message and the seriousness of what can go wrong. And I mean, Roger can tell you a lot of different stories about the different people that he's seen over the years that have come with really no idea of what they're getting into, and some of the lengths that Roger's had to go to kind of drive home the message. So it puts us in a tough spot at times, but you know, it is what it is.
Roger, could you share one of those maybe with us, as far as how serious, if someone like me were to come, who frankly has no business being on that mountain.
Yeah, I have a lot of stories there. There's one that I'm just thinking of at this moment this was, again, there's always like, why are they here? But this was a guy from Mexico, and he was a writer and was doing a story about Denali. And as far as he was aware, Denali was an easy climb, and he'd, you know, get up and down the thing in a week or so, maybe 10 days, and was going solo, of course. That's where most of our problems happen with these solo guys and gals. But in any case, you know, I tried to dissuade him I wanted him to get with a group, you know, take more time, not climb at all, you know, every avenue. Anyway, he took off, and from what I understood, he had an okay trip. And you can kind of track somebody a little bit. You'd ask about them at different camps, and we have good communication. Well, it was on his way back down, and I kept thinking, gosh, this guy's going to write this story out exactly what he wanted, you know, that the mountain was easy, that he could just go solo up the thing. Well, on the way back down, just above Windy Corner, we have these little crevasses that are along the trail, and some of them are kind of hit and miss with knowing what you're doing. Well, this guy fell in, or actually his sled went into this crevasse. And of course, your sled's only anchored behind you like 6 feet, 8 feet back, so really close. And it had all of his stuff. He didn't have a pack on his back. He put all his junk on his sled. Well, it literally started dragging him into the crevasse. And and he had his ski poles and his crampons on, no ice axe, fell over and laid there on the snow. Every time he tried to pull that up, it would jerk him closer into the crevasse. And his feet were probably only a foot away from that crevasse and, you know, ready to be yarded down in and disappear because those crevasses there are pretty deep. And so he laid there for hours. And finally some group comes by up the trail, just like we do, very slowly. They see this guy laying there and say, "Hey, you need a hand?" And that guy says, "Oh, you're saving me. You're saving me." And so I got the story from him when he came back. He said, "Oh, my God, Denali is not an easy mountain to get up. I mean, you can take it easy, but if you have one problem, it can cost you." So okay. It was that was one of those little stories to, you know, luckily nothing happened to him. But
right.
He did pass on a much better message to his readers out there. So
sure. Yeah. And, you know, when one thing, you know, we're talking about last year being such a good year relative as far as, you know, rescues and the need for rescues go. How much of a factor, because last year we did have a really pretty nice summer as well, you know, and I know you said climber awareness and climber training plays a big part in that, but Roger, you were saying that one of the things that gets built into people's expeditions is waiting on the weather and, you know, the risk of 100-mile-an-hour winds and things right. like that. So, you know, I asked for some of the extremes earlier, but on a general expedition, I mean, how many days can people generally expect to wait on the weather?
Well, hopefully, you know, if you're going on a reasonable schedule and you have your 3 weeks of food, generally you hope to not have more than a week of bad weather in that period of time. If it starts pushing your schedule out beyond your 21 days, you know, you just may miss the top entirely. I mean, you may get okay. up to a high point. But ideally, I mean, the best climbing weather is a bad storm every 2 days or 3 days, one 24-hour bad weather event, so it stops everybody. They all are forced to acclimatize. Years like last year, we didn't have any of those. Luckily, people just took their time. We didn't see a lot of altitude-related problems up high, but the worst conditions are when we have a big storm and then we get a small break, and everyone's going to go fast at that point, and okay. We start seeing issues up high when that happens. But on the average, we do get a storm every, you know, once a week or so, and it stops everyone, and they all have some good stories about it, and and that's our best kind of rate I've seen.
Okay, so you say actually too much good weather can potentially be a problem as well, because
it can be. Yep. Okay. And too much bad weather, people will go out in the bad weather too, and try to do things when they probably shouldn't be out because they've been waiting so long. And then, of course, a little later in the season, we start getting the avalanche danger from those, and that's always a real concern. We have lost some people that way.
Right. One more thing, and then we'll take a brief break here. Just remind everyone, if you do want to join in on the conversation with Roger Robinson and John Leonard of the National Park Service here for Denali National Park, you can call 733-1200. Or send us an email at dj@ktna.org, or go to our Facebook page and send us a message there. We do have all of those up and running for you. So one question before we take a quick break here is summit day. So you've made it up to high camp at 17,000 feet, and you think you're going to have a weather window to make the summit bid. Can you explain to me how summit day works? Kind of chronologically,
yeah.
I guess.
Generally, you're kind of prepared for that through the night. And, you know, summit day isn't a real early start day. Most places in the world, you want to get alpine start. It's before the sun comes up and get going. On Denali, you want to be climbing when the sun's out. And so you don't even want to start moving until the sun is actually on the route above the camp at high camp, and that faces west. That means it's a really late time of day to get going, but you're better to wait for that sun to be out. So, you know, a 10 o'clock start in the morning, there's nothing wrong with that, and that way it puts you up on top, say 8 hours later, and you got all day to get up and down and with that sun out to the west. It doesn't set until midnight or so. So you have a very long time to get up and down, and so you base it around that kind of start. And then Then you want to try to get up through Denali Pass in a reasonable amount of time. If you're taking too long, like 2.5, 3, or 4 hours, you probably ought to turn around. You're just way, way too slow. Now, if you're leaving with a lot of other people, generally they all get kind of caught up in one long line. And we do have anchors that are up there that people use, and that takes a bit of time to clip through those ice or snow pickets that are there. They're about every 20, 30 meters stretched out across the upper slope of the traverse to the Denali Pass traverse. But once you turn that corner, you hope that the wind is going to be reasonable at the pass. I always tell folks that there's often wind at the pass, and if the wind dies down once you get above it, it's a good go. But if the wind is still strong or increasing above the pass, it's not very probably a good idea to turn it back down.
Okay.
It's going to be really nasty up high. But you just take your time. And once you're up into the football field and beyond, which
and that's right before.
Yeah, it's not like 19,600, 19,700 feet. You're breathing really hard. I mean, you're usually breathing two breaths per step or so, maybe even three. You're just really huffing, and you really can't get enough oxygen. You're just getting as much air as you can. And if you haven't acclimatized very well, it may be starting to really feel the effects of altitude at that point, more than just breathing hard. You could be experiencing some headache, a little nausea. It's kind of common.
Okay.
But and then Summit Ridge, it's not a easy thing to go through. I've been up there once when it was blowing about 30, and it was about as much as we could handle. We put in anchors. We were crabbing along the side of it. It was tricky, and we got on top. It was still blowing, and we just turned right around and went back down.
So about how long do people tend to spend on the summit, on the top of North America? I mean, obviously, you said you got up, basically tagged it, and said, all right, we're going back down.
Yeah, well, our first trip, we were probably an hour and a half or 2 hours, okay. 75. My last trip, we tagged it and went back off. So, yeah.
Just enough to say you had done it.
Yeah, I took a few photos, and I was worried about things getting worse.
Sure.
And just turned right around.
Yeah. Okay. Well, great. When we come back, we have plenty more topics to discuss on Denali in the second, slightly less than half hour. If you want to join in, call 733-1200, send an email to dj@ktna.org, or shoot us a message on Facebook, and we will be watching that. So we'll be back with the second half hour of Susitna Valley Voice with guests Roger Robinson and John Leonard. Thanks for listening. Back. My name is Philip Manning here with Susitna Valley Voice. My guests today are John Leonard and Roger Robinson of the National Park Service here for Denali National Park, both heavily involved in the Denali operations of the park. If you want to get in on our conversation, if you have questions about mountaineering, about Denali, about the Park Service. You can call 733-1200, send an email to dj@ktna.org, or go to our Facebook page and get us a message that way. During the break there, one of the things that I mentioned that I wanted to discuss, because it is in the news right now, is the tragedy on Everest. And I've talked to a few people around town who have some experience up there. John, I understand you've been up to attempted Everest in the past. What sort of impact does something like this have on the global climbing community?
You know, I don't know how it's going to affect the climbing community. I know just from a very basic human level, it's just such a very sad thing. You know, the Sherpa are just such a wonderful people and culture. You know, they're there not because they necessarily enjoy climbing. That's their means in which they feed their families. And it's just a job, where the rest of us go there because we have some other ambitions and it's fun and, you know, we want to challenge ourselves and climb the highest point on the planet. They're simply there just, you know, to provide for their families. And, you know, we here at the park over the years have forged a relationship with the Sherpa community, and they are the most wonderful people that you'll ever come in contact with. And it's been something that's been really neat for us. About 6 years ago, Brandon Latham, one of our rangers here, put in place what we call a Sherpa exchange. And climbing Sherpas come over from just right after their Mount Everest season and come here and volunteer at the park and share their knowledge with us, and we share our knowledge with them. Obviously, in many ways, they're much more experienced at higher elevations, and they pass that knowledge and ability on to us as best they can. And we try to pass along to them some different things that we do, is trying to keep people safe, as well as what our environmental ethics are and how you keep mountains clean that are used by lots of different people.
Sure. And that actually does bring up an interesting point that I want to discuss as well. But I guess one thing in regard to the actual topography and features of the mountain, the way I understand it is where this happened on Everest is in the midst of an ice fall, which is kind of where you get a glacier going over a really steep piece of terrain. Is there on Denali, on the climbing routes that people take on Denali, are there features like that? Is there a risk of something like that happening to someone trying to climb Denali?
So the night the accident happened, I just happened to be surfing the internet, and there was actual video of the full accident that happened. And what happened there was a big ice block calved off, or a big serac calved off from up high. And for people to kind of imagine that, it's similar to when glaciers or tidal glaciers are down in the water and big ice chunks fall off in the ocean. And so a big piece of ice fell off from up high above the ice fall, actually, and then came crashing down the ice fall and then just propagated all the way through the ice fall where all the Sherpa were at.
Okay, and so the way that the Denali routes work, is that something that could happen on the buttress?
It could. A couple of years ago, we had an accident that a gentleman died over in the Ruth Glacier, not on Denali, but up in the Root Canal, where a huge serac calved off and came crashing down onto the Root Canal Glacier, and then that blast and debris from that hit a couple of groups that were up there climbing, and one gentleman lost his life from it. But okay, throughout the range, there's a number of different places where there's hanging glaciers, and big events like that have happened, and will happen.
Yeah, up in the northeast fork of the Kehultna, it's a little ways out of base camp where people go to climb south face routes, including the West Rib and Cassine. We call this a valley of death, and you're literally walking underneath those a lot of big hanging seracs. And years ago, in my earlier years working here, we had a group of four very accomplished climbers disappear in that area. They just vanished. We assume that's probably what happened to them.
So that's one of those situations where, John, I think you mentioned it earlier, wrong place, wrong time, and there's not necessarily a lot that you can do about it in that case.
Yeah, some you know, we try to analyze all the different accidents, and sometimes it just comes down to that. You can do everything right, but if you're going to go into terrain where there's hazards, sometimes bad things are going to happen. And that's you know, what happened over in the Kumbh Icefall is they were there at the right time, the right day. It was in the morning hours, but an event happened that it's predictable in the sense that eventually it will happen. It does happen, and they've had issues there with that particular icefall. But it's hard to say exactly when it's going to happen. So
okay. Looks like we have an email question here. So this is from Jock here in Talkeetna. It says he wants to know about high-altitude nutrition and what kind of food works best, including for summit day, and then electrolyte and water intake. So what are people eating up there? What should they be eating, yeah. I suppose, is the better question.
You know, we have Roger, what do you think? How many different countries are represented each year?
I think we have like 30 countries, 35 every year, different folks, and they're all eating different food items. They try to find some of this in the U.S., but they often bring over some select things. You know, the crazy thing for summit day is, you know, you're eating whatever that's going to be decent. I mean, what you like to eat, because you haven't been eating well at high camp anyway. Hmm. And so often what may not seem like a really palatable or a really good energy type of thing may not be as you may just be eating a bunch of candy bars and you know, and you had some kind of breakfast that you could keep down in the morning and it just powered up with a bunch of candy bars. And you know, we used to make special breads and all this, and there's all types of energy bars, but it probably boils down to about that. Hmm. You know, most people are gonna get by with some kind of energy bars and candy bars and
lots of carbs.
Yeah, a lot of carbs and eating them all a whole bunch. But again, you're not, you know, you want to be eating any fat, like keeping butter out of your food entirely at high camp. And your body doesn't process it.
Really?
It doesn't go down that well up high. Even though a little lower at 14,000, you can just, you know, eat a lot of it.
So when you say that you haven't been eating well at high camp, that's what you mean? You got to really cut fat?
You know, you're losing a lot of weight. High camp is a place, would be a great place to go to lose lots of weight quick.
At 17,000
yeah,
feet.
Yeah. I mean, if you could, you know, if you want to lose 10 pounds, I'll go up there and spend, you'd probably lose a pound a day.
Oh, wow.
So in
10 careful,
days.
You'll start the next fad diet.
Right. So, yeah, that question, you know, then electrolytes are important. I mean, you want more than just water, and that's, most people are pretty good at putting something in. Most people know they got to be drinking, whether they drink or not, but they are taking you know, electrolytes, you know, in their water bottles.
So is that as simple as like salt pills or
no just electrolyte drinks?
Okay.
Yeah, you know what is, you know, so you find them all, you know, all kinds, but
sure,
adding powder and electrolyte different kinds. And yeah,
okay, cool. Well, hopefully that that answers Jock's question. Basically, especially once you get up high, it's whatever you can stomach is what you eat.
It really boils down to that.
And a lot of it. So, okay. Well, one thing I do want to cover, we're here in about the last 15 minutes of the show. If you wanted to join in on the conversation as well, just remind everyone you can call 733-1200. You can send us an email at dj@ktna.org, or you can find us on Facebook and get us a message that way. But one thing I did want to talk about is the environment around Denali in the Alaska Range. Roger, I know you've done a lot of work on that In fact, many, many moons ago, there was a story on NPR about clean mountain cans and things like that. So what I want to discuss is what can be done, and John, you mentioned it as well, when you have a mountain with thousands of people or more than 1,000 people every year on it, what can you do to try to preserve that for future generations? And what are, obviously, clean, well, I guess we can start with clean mountain cans. So, Roger, you were the pioneer of that program up here. Yeah. So can you explain to me, what is a clean mountain can?
Well, it's a little portable toilet is really all it is, a small little 2-gallon, this little can, little plastic container that you sit on and go, and you line it with a biodegradable bag. And very, very simple, but it was created over a means of trying to pack out human waste from the upper parts of the mountain, or seeing if we could get all the waste off the mountain. It seemed like in my climbing history that we just didn't have a good way to deal with the waste up high. The hike camp was getting more and more polluted. It was just a very bad place. In fact, there had been discussion about closing the hike camp for a period of time, let it clean itself. That was so bad, and there you just couldn't hardly go anywhere to find snow to melt for clean water, and there was just feces everywhere you went. You found feces up there, you know, we attempted all kinds of different means. We even had an outhouse where we had a big container underneath that we had to shift to down the slope to supposedly little teeny crevasses that it really didn't fit into. I mean, it was a complete disaster, and. So taking what people do on river trips, I thought maybe it would be possible to try to do that. Okay. A lot of river trips in the U.S. require waste to be brought out, and they use something called an ammo box, a really just portable toilet. And, so we in the year 19 or the year 2000 experimented that way. And, with some ammo boxes on Denali, and they were heavy and they were large and they held a lot of waste, but we brought all our waste off that year, and I felt it was totally doable, but it would take a lot of convincing of people to try to do it. But I know generally climbers want to be doing things right. It's tougher probably for the general public, but most climbers have an awareness to the environment, and so for the next several years we did experimentation with different types of what we ended up calling the clean mountain can, and getting people voluntarily removing their waste. And it evolved within 3 years to something that everyone was required to do at hike camp. And I was really taken back that it people willingly brought their waste off of hike camp, and were proud to do it. We literally had people bring their waste into the ranger station and show us what they brought down. You know, and it was like... And the very first ones we did, and we don't let them do that today. But I was amazed that people bought into it fairly quickly, and today it's just a standard here, and it's evolving around the world.
Interesting. So after these portable toilets get brought down off the mountain, and they don't bring them inside the ranger station anymore, but presumably that does get dropped off. What happens to it then?
Well, we've worked commercial, an outfit commercially cleans those, takes them down valley and has them cleaned and then brought back, and they get recycled over and over and over again.
Okay.
We have a small number that do get destroyed or lost each year, but the number is actually quite small compared to the amount of numbers we actually send out. So okay. We have about 10 that we lose a year from either destroyed or lost out of the 1,000 that go out, 1,000, right. 1,500 that literally get cycled in and out.
Right. And then as far as the contents go, I understand you've got some ideas as far as what might be done with that in order to...
Currently, climbers are allowed to crevasse their waste. Once they get out of high camp and down to the 14,000-foot level, people are permitted to put their waste in crevasses, and we provide each of the clean mountain cans are lined with, we have these special biodegradable bags that are used, and so the waste is crevassed. But in recent years, the waste does eventually move downhill, and research that the park has paid to have done has found that the waste does not break down in the glacier. And so when that waste eventually comes to the surface, it is still active and live, and it's not a good thing.
So you're talking about like E. coli, fecal coliform,
yes,
that sort of thing.
Yes, fecal coliform, E. coli, yep. And so, you know, the thought's been given to try to get all the waste brought off. There is a portion brought off now, especially people that just hang around certain camps. And it is required at all the little glacier airstrips throughout the range to, if someone's camping there, they're supposed to bring all their waste out. So, and a lot of these folks are really good at that. They get it off. But so getting down to so my thought was, well, why have this stuff taken all the way down to Wasilla, cleaned, and then that waste actually is taken all the way to Anchorage, and then it's put into the inlet in the end. And Anchorage doesn't have the cleanest sewer system either. I mean, they put E. coli and fecal coliform into Cook Inlet. And way I look at it is it could possibly be processed right here, but maybe composted rather than dealt with in our sewer system here. And so I've experimented, and I have a 3-year project that I'm wrapping up this year with composting climber's waste using red worms. And so far the results have been pretty amazing. And so I've been doing this little project, and it's just a small portion of what would come off. But from what I see, it's probably totally doable.
Okay.
Someone could take this waste, the bags and all, and have it composted, and within 3 years, there isn't any pathogen left in it.
Interesting. And so potentially a way for climbers to contribute a little bit to.
Well, it would be, you know, but it means a lot more, because if people, I mean, even what we have could be composted.
Hmm.
And if all the waste came off, that could all be composted. So it would, you know, instead of having any left in the park, it could all come off and be dealt with locally.
Hmm.
And wouldn't have any really adverse effect on the environment. You know, climbers are paying for the system now, and it would probably not add any additional amount to make it happen that way.
Okay. We've got just under 10 minutes left here. If you want to join in on the conversation with John Leonard and Roger Robinson of the National Park Service here in Denali National Park, you can give us a call, 733-1200, send us an email, dj@ktna.org, or head to our Facebook site and send us a question that way. I am currently monitoring all of those. So as far as to slightly shift gears, but stay environmentally focused, looking forward, what is the park looking at as far as future efforts for environmental conservation? You know, I've heard from many climbers who have been climbing since the 60s and 70s talking about the receding of glaciers, things like that, which we may not necessarily be able to impact here at the local level. But what can be done to help preserve the mountain for future generations beyond what's already being done?
Want me to take that? You know, I would say that, you know, if people can just leave their foot tracks up there, you know, and that would be the ultimate goal, you know, go up and climb and not leave anything back, leave anything on the mountain. That'd be the ultimate goal. You know, we're getting close to that. I mean, people obviously have urine, but it's fairly sterile. But there are means of dealing with that, too. There's been research at managing that where, because people tend to go in the same places, and there are ways to actually add a chemical to the urine and take the odor out of it.
Hmm.
But in any case, you know, I think if we see, you know, huge increases of climbers on Denali. Right now we have a limit, but that'll be reviewed again in a couple of years. You know, it could handle, you know, a lot of folks, but it'll end up being a safety concern.
Hmm.
And then we also may see the routes change to where they're not as friendly anymore. Windy Corner, above Windy Corner, there's a significant amount of rockfall now at certain times, and that's not going to stop. I think we're going to see more and more of that. And definitely the airstrip at base camp has degraded more and more through the years. you know, and we cross our fingers each year that it's still flyable there. There really isn't any good another good spot found nearby. And it might be many more miles to climb the mountain if they have to land, say, down by Little Switzerland or some side glacier 10 miles away. So, you know, it's an evolving thing with the climate or with the conditions changing on Denali. And but my hope is that as far as people go on is just to leave their foot tracks.
Right, that's the old backpacker's creed, right? Take only pictures, leave only footprints.
Yep.
So, okay. And so as we're looking forward, I mean, like I said, I've heard many, many people tell me about the impacts of global climate change, global warming, whatever you want to call it. It's I've had a lot of people tell me that it is a reality, or at least glacier retreat is an undeniable reality, whether or not what it's caused by. Maybe up, may or may not be up for debate, but glacier retreat is an undeniable reality. So as we go forward, looking at you know, beyond Denali itself, are there other parts of the Alaska Range? Because we do have climbers that go all over the place up there. Are there other parts of the Alaska Range that are getting more impacted than others by that? Either John or Roger.
You know what I've seen in my time here is it seems to me significant or definitely noticeable. I think you know, about mid to late July, where now there's huge amounts of standing water on the Kiltna Glacier. A year ago, it looked like you could almost, if you were in a kayak, you can go from the base of Ski Hill down to the base of Heartbreak Hill.
And that's just right above base camp.
Right. So up at 7,000 feet, there's just an enormous amount of standing water on the glacier. You know, we were talking about extremes in weather a little bit earlier. Last year was a very, very warm year, and that created, as Roger's mentioned earlier, a situation where there was a lot of rockfall coming down at Windy Corner, and it'll be interesting to see what the dynamics of that are this year.
Okay.
So there's things happening, and you know, we're not going to say necessarily what's causing them, but there are objective things that we can point to that there is definitely a change.
Okay. And so I guess just briefly as we wrap up, you know, I've used the word Denali exclusively. Officially, according to the federal government, your employer, it is Mount McKinley. Multiple efforts have been made to change the mountain. Those have all been hung up. But beyond that, what I wanted to talk about briefly here as we close is the mountain got a bit of a haircut from the U.S. Geological Survey last year, lost 83 feet, I believe, to 20,237 from 20,320. And I was just curious if that has any sort of administrative impact even on you guys there at the Ranger Station. Do you have to change letterhead or documents or T-shirts or anything like that? Or are we just going to keep going as always?
I tell you, I had just gotten comfortable with remembering the 20,320, and now it's a whole new number, which I don't even remember. What did you say it was?
It's a...
You know, I was kind of joking, and I was hoping that it would shrunk, and Mount Logan would now become the highest peak in North America, and that would change our workload a bit.
The new number is 20,237, and when I mentioned that to Dave Johnston here locally, he rattled off. He's like, oh, that's the same 237. That's the same as X Peak down in Canada and so on and so forth. So,
yeah, no impacts. It was really interesting, the story that became.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a little lost on me why a new measurement would create such a fuss. But for some reason, the state put out that as a big story and breaking news. And it must have been a slow news day because it was picked up from sources all around the world.
Well,
and the world did not come to an end.
So. I might have contributed to that somewhat. I'm not completely blameless as far as that goes. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. That's all the time we've got for today on Susitna Valley Voice. My guests have been John Leonard and Roger Robinson of the National Park Service. If you missed any of our discussion on mountaineering on Denali or want to hear it again, we'll be airing the show again tonight at 7 o'clock, or you'll be able to listen anytime at ktna.org. Thanks for listening.